Now, the Public Expenditure Minister, Michael McGrath, under whose remit the social welfare budget historically falls, is just up on his feet in the last 7 or 8 minutes. So, to a degree, Nat O'Connor, Senior Public Affairs and Policy Specialist at Age Action, and I are flying blind somewhat. But, Nat, nonetheless, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much indeed.
As I said at the outset, quite a significant amount of kite flowing with this budget in tandem with previous budgets. We're expecting a €5 increase to the state pension, bringing it up somewhere to the region of €253 per week. But that has prompted you to call for proper benchmarking and indexation of the state pension, lest those increases be gobbled up by the inflation that we're experiencing currently.
Absolutely. This is the concern. I mean, Age Action for many years has called for an indexing of the pension, which is common in the UK and other European countries. That would mean that there's, you know, evidence is gathered of how the cost of living is affecting older people, and the pension would rise automatically. So if you consider that since January of 2019, the value of the pension, its purchasing power, has fallen by €10.24. Now, that's nearly €542 a year less that you can buy, which might be filling up the tank with home heating oil or doing some repairs around the house or keeping a car on the road in a rural area. And so those are very significant loss of purchasing power of the pension. So €5 a week, if the minister comes good on that, and all signals are he will, you know, will certainly help. But what we're looking for is a kind of a tighter linking of the cost of living with the pension, so the pension keeps pace.
I know that earlier TD Paul Murphy referred to Budget Day as National Fiver Day, and there's some truth in that, as for successive years, a fiver a week added on to the state pension. That does not keep pace with inflation, and also in many ways it seems a tokenistic way to increase it, because it has no regard to what's occurring in wider society and the costs that older people may be incurring on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. I mean, in the UK, for example, it's linked not only to the cost of living, but also to average wages. So that is, you know, society is becoming more prosperous. Those who rely on the pension or other welfare should also, you know, have some share. I mean, it's a modest share of that prosperity as well. So they're not left behind. I mean, it's all about social inclusion at the end of the day. So certainly a fiver a week, I mean, that kind of politics is not doing us any good. We want to take the politics out of the state pension, you know, so that people would have a certainty that there'd be an automatic rise in the pension if we had the indexation system. And indeed, we saw the Pensions Commission reported last week. We have the sort of the big report that they did about the reform of the state pension system, and they've also recommended an indexation of the state pension.
However, what might be a significant stumbling block to that, and has been very much a stumbling block to the introduction of auto-enrolment in state pensions for, I think, some 2 decades, is the nature of the Irish political system, in that most TDs and senators will plan for the current dole or a rock this term and then to get back in thereafter. This is why there is such ongoing discourse about the increase in the state pension age. I don't think I've talked about it more in my entire career than I have in the last month or so. And if you're to put indexation into the link, into the mix there, would that not require an increase in the state pension age in order to generate the funds to keep pace with rising inflation and in order that the pension retain its ongoing day-to-day value?
No is the simple answer. I mean, and to explain it, I mean, there's two separate issues there. I mean, certainly we need to fund the state pension, we need to fund it properly. And the Pensions Commission has brought out a range of measures in terms of, say, social insurance that we would all pay throughout our working lives to fund the pension system, so it would be sufficient for all of us. And what we're focused on is ensuring that we're funding an adequate pension. Everybody knows it'll be basic, but people pay their social insurance and have done for 40, 50 years on the basis that they'll get a basic but adequate pension at the end. And that's what we're, you know, fighting to maintain that. What we're worried about is people who are then trying to change the contract, if you like, after the date, by trying to shrinking the state pension, whether shrinking the amount of it so it's no longer adequate, or shrinking the amount of time that we get it, shrinking, you know, by raising the retirement age. And that's, you know, that's a slippery slope. We do have to take some hard decisions about how we fund the state pension, and, you know, that needs to be looked at seriously, and everybody needs to pay their share. But other countries have a much larger proportion of older people. They have more generous pension systems, and they manage to fund them, you know, with lower pension ages. So we can do it too if the national will is there to do it.
Nat O'Connor, Senior Public Affairs and Policy Specialist at Age Action, thank you indeed for joining us. And we await that effective confirmation by Michael McGrath in the coming moments of the increase of the state pension by around a fiver to €253.50. We're also anticipating an increase in the fuel allowance. I'm going to take you through a couple of the measures that have already been confirmed within the last hour. So one of them is a €520 million tax package. And that will mean that the rate at which people pay the higher rate of tax is being increased by €1,500, while the personal tax credit, employee tax credit and earned income credit is being increased by €50. The minimum wage is rising by 30 cents to €10.50 an hour, and the ceiling for the second band of USC is rising to €21,295. The EWSS scheme is being extended in a graduated way until the 30th of April 2022. No change in October and November. Businesses still availing on New Year's Eve will get it until April 30th. In December, January and February, a two-rate structure of €151.50 and €203 will apply. On housing, a zoned land tax will be introduced applying to land zoned for housing and serviced but is not being developed. There will be a two-year lead-in time for that and 3 years for land zoned after 2022, and the rate there will be 3% of the market rate. It will crucially operate on a self-assessed basis. The Help to Buy scheme, meanwhile, will be retained for 2022 at the current rate. In terms of all things motor related, a revised motor tax system is being introduced. 1% increase in VRT for bands 9 to 12, 2% for bands 13 to 15 and 4% for bands 16 to 20. There's also an extension of €5,000 relief for the battery electric vehicles to the end of 2023. And that well-flagged €7.50 increase in the carbon tax has also been announced. And the price of the most popular packets of cigarettes is going up to €15. Excise on a 20-pack of cigarettes is going up 50 cent, with a similar increase on other tobacco products based on their price. We'll pop back in with what Michael McGrath is telling us a little bit later. Now, I'm joined on the line by Patrick Jackson. He's founder and chief executive of Picker Pals, and he is recruiting here in County Kildare. Patrick, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara.
And tell us, what is Picker Pals and what is it you're aiming to spark in smaller children?
Well, we're a litter picking programme. It's an environmental awareness programme for lower primary classrooms. And we're aiming to actually rid Ireland of litter over the next few years and get rid of littering as a thing. And we think we've got the solution. And I'd love to tell your listeners a little bit about it, the ones who aren't listening to the budget.
Please do.
So what we do is we equip classrooms with a special picker pack, and that contains the tools that a family would need to go out litter picking. And then this pack, which is made out of upcycled dinghy sails, goes home with one child every few days, and then they go out with the family and they do a little litter pick, and they come back, and then in the next time they go to school, they bring it back for the next child. And they fill in a report and they get a membership card, and they also get some storybooks all about the Picker Pals characters, who are, they're anti-litter heroes, and the storybooks and workbooks. So everyone kind of gets involved across from the classroom through to the home, and we're having a lot of fun and success with the program, and we've got some funding and we'd like to clean up Kildare.
It sounds as much like a de facto teamwork and community building program, as well as having a focus on getting people to grow up with the concept of keeping your own area clean.
Very much so, yes. And parents have really responded very well to it. I think they like the fact that it's something, I think one County Kerry said, Kerry makes litter picking homework, or, this kind of idea is that we're actually doing something useful. It's building a bridge between the home and the school. And teachers love it because it's easy for them. They just send the pack home, and everyone's having fun with it. The kids are mad for it. Because they, I think we're kind of programmed to go out and about and pick things up genetically. So Yeah, it's fun.
It also sounds like a really positive way to use pester power. We all know what small children are like when they see something they want, or they get hold of an idea that really, really grasps them and lights them up, in that they will bring that idea home. They will pester everybody in the household until they get on board. And this is a great way to use that skill, if you will, that small children are born with.
Yeah, and we have... We've some lovely testimonials from parents talking to us about how, you know, their kids have really brought about behavioural change in their homes, and that's spread. The idea is really that it's not just litter. Obviously, it's a whole mindset about the environment and about the things we use and about just caring for the world and doing, you know, things that we can do. And I think for kids. They get a lot of news about big, giant environmental issues, and this is one thing that they can really roll their sleeves up. And so, yeah, that's the idea. And thanks a million for we are looking for school, primary schools to reach out to us. We're on Pick a Pal's World if you push into Google. And we've got funding to do another. We've still got a few available in Kildare, so get them while they're hot.
And Patrick, is there a deadline? Is there a limit on the number of schools that can join for this particular cycle? Because there are slightly over 100 primary schools in Kildare.
Yeah, now I should know the number off the top of my head, but it's something like 60 places, 60 classrooms. So some schools might have more than one pack, but nationwide we're going to be doing 1,250 classrooms in the country. So last year it was 200 and we got the chance to really ramp it up this time. So, yeah, I think it's 60 in Kildare, and I think we're up to about 45. So I think we've got maybe 15 or 20 places available left. So,
and is there a deadline or is enrolment ongoing?
It's what it is. They say when they're gone, they're gone. But we'll do our best. You know, we'd like to hear from anyone. We've got a waiting list and. We'll get round to everyone at some stage.
Well, Patrick Jackson, founder and chief executive of Pick Our Pals, thank you indeed for joining us. Michael McGrath has begun on the social welfare section even of the budget. So €5 a week for working age welfare payments. That's including €5 for young job seekers. They are, of course, on a different rate. €10 on the back to school allowance. €10 on the working family payment. Domiciliary care allowance goes from 3 to 6 months. The rate of wage subsidy scheme for people with disabilities will rise by €1 per week. An increase in the income disregard for the carer's allowance. Earning limits on disability allowance from €350 to €375. There is a reduction in the number of contributions for treatment benefits from 260 to 39 weeks. A 100% Christmas bonus will be announced shortly. And the fuel allowance has increased by €5 a week. There's also an increase in the qualified children rate for the under 12s by €2 and for over 12s by €3. So we'll bring you more as it is to hand. The budget is still being delivered in Dáil Éireann this afternoon. I want to say a very happy birthday to Daniel Percival of Milltown. He turns 14 today. That's from his dad, Dennis, whose birthday is this Thursday. And that is love always from Nanny and Mammy. That came in to us on 0833 97 97 97, and that is the number for all of your comments, your requests, your dedications. Now, there is a new proposal which may reduce the amount of time that people who commit serious offences are likely to receive off their sentences. It's usually called remission. To discuss this, joined on the line now by Fina Ní Chineda. She's Executive Director at the Irish Penal Reform Trust. Fina, you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
I would imagine a lot of people hearing that saying, well, look, you've been convicted of a serious offence. You have been sentenced to a particular amount of time. What harm if you have to serve your whole sentence?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, remission is quite hard to communicate and understand. So what's being proposed here is a review of the current remission systems that are in place. Media headlines have focused on the taking away of remission, but we're clear that this is an opportunity to actually improve the system by expanding access to enhanced remission. So in practice, currently in Ireland, automatic remission is applied to determinate sentences. So there are certain exclusions, such as life sentence being the most obvious one. So 25% reduction is applied to the sentence. And people in prison, men and women, can access 33% remission, so a third of their sentence, if they demonstrate, if they meet certain criteria and show that they're committed to rehabilitation and they put the head down, attending, you know, education, job and work. So that's the current situation. Now, we don't know what is proposed in terms of what this review intends to achieve, but we would note that 25% remission is very low in Ireland in comparison to Europe and indeed our nearest neighbours. In England, Wales, it's automatically applied at 50%, similar in Scotland, and it's even higher for younger offenders or first-time offenders. So we're out of kilter. And I suppose the other thing that's important to communicate to listeners really is that it sounds like a reduction, but in fact, standard remission is so firmly established as part of the sentencing culture of the Irish legal system that we can assume that sentencing judges calibrate their sentencing to reflect the reality at the rate of standard remission. So any changes would need to be, you know, proceed with caution because it's just it's embedded in our sentencing practice.
And I imagine, and this is a completely hypothetical question, were standard remission to be non-standard, for example, that the prison system would have an incredibly difficult time in coping. It's nearly skewed to standard remission because it would mean that were that not to exist, the amount of time an individual prisoner would spend incarcerated would increase, thereby increasing the overall prison population. And I sincerely doubt the resources are there to manage and support that.
Exactly. I mean, that would just be, quite frankly, a disastrous situation. So any changes, you know, positive or negative, need to be supported by a full impact assessment, you know, to see what the implications are for prisons' capacity and overcrowding, because you could end up with this, you know, recurrent cycle where you're increasing overcrowding, which in turn increases the presence of drugs, violence, decreases access to rehabilitation, increases poor behaviour, so people lose remission, and then that contributes to more people in prison, increased overcrowding, and it's a recurring cycle, and that is to be avoided at all costs. But aside from that, the other aspect of this, Ciara, that we'd be very concerned is just generally the disproportionate, or what would I say, unequal access to the prison rules and enhanced regimes. And indeed, there's another form of incentivized regime where prisoners get different privileges according to what level they're on within the prison. And our research has found that older people in prison, for example, who can't participate in work and education, but also people with disabilities, including mental illness, can't always participate in those regimes which allow them to access the enhanced levels. And we're particularly concerned about people with disabilities or people for whom English isn't their first language, who don't know what the prison rules are, that they're not explained to them, they don't understand them, and then they can make, you know, unwittingly breach of the prison rules and then get punished for what is effectively a form of disability or just, you know, being from a different country. So there's a whole picture here that needs to be addressed, along with access to a complaints appeal mechanism and an independent complaints mechanism overall.
And all of this has to take place within the context of the fact that if the state elects, for whatever reason, to curtail someone's freedom, the state then becomes responsible for that person's care, regardless of the nature of the crime for which they have been committed.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So, you know, and over the last year now, we've had a very mixed view. So, of course, we have seen a very strong focus on the state's obligations and duties to people in its custody and in other institutions as well. But if we're talking about the prison system here, so for example, so the state under different international human rights treaties has obligations to uphold the highest standards of physical care and mental health care. And we would say that the focus on, so the prison system has been very successful and is to be commended in what it has achieved in terms of very low rates of COVID-19 infection among prisoners. From last week, it was a total since March 2020 of 185 prisoners and just over 400 officers, which is incredible. But we also have to ask, at what cost and what has the impact been on mental health care within prison and access to regimes? And really, we will only see that impact will only be known in times to come.
But in terms of this particular review, Fiona, there are five key pillars which you are encouraging those who will be engaging in the assessment to pay particular heed to. You mentioned equality and equity, safeguards there to ensuring decisions are made in an open and transparent way. And perhaps arguably the most important pillar is that is an in-depth analysis of sentencing data. And I cannot imagine that kind of work is undertaken frequently in Ireland.
Well, now, I suppose let's start with the positive here. So currently there isn't. So it's widely acknowledged that sentencing data is fairly scant in Ireland. We don't have adequate sight in it. However, with the passing of the Judicial Council Act in 2019 and the establishment of what's called the Sentencing Guidelines and Information Committee in summer 2020, now we are seeing moves to address that. We know that there are research tenders out there, and a team, I think in Scotland, are putting together a basic framework for analysis of sentencing in Ireland. So we hope to see significant improvements in that regard in future, because the reality is we're guessing, you know. So what would be important in this case, for example, to go back to your first question about, you know, remission, and we need to know to what extent judges do calculate automatic remission when setting down their offence. We need to see what are the outcomes. So let's track the outcomes of people who are released early. International research tells us that early release supports reduced recidivism on release and enhances rehabilitation in prisons. This is down to fairness, treating procedural fairness, and also trust. We know that. So what we need to see is investment in the sentencing data and research that demonstrates those outcomes and informs better policy.
Fiona Ní Chineada, Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust. Thank you. Is vaccine hoarding a kind of genocide? That is the question certainly posed and explored by my next guest, Vittorio Bufacci of the Department of Philosophy, University College Cork. Vittorio, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
I suppose a lot of people might have an instinctive reaction that yes, it is. But when they think deeper from their perspective in, you know, a developed country which has a well-advanced vaccination programme, they might think, well, no, maybe it's not.
Right. So we need to break this down before we get to the genocide part. So the article that I published last week for RT Brainstorm is a development of the book that I published last June called Everything Must Change, which was my philosophical lessons from lockdown. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is how the pandemic brought out the very worst in us in many ways, things that we don't like to admit to. And so if you think back at the very start of the pandemic, you know, people were hoarding toilet paper because there was the panic that we may run out. And, you know, that hoarding is about I have to look after myself and my selfish motivations, and I'm not worrying or caring about the others. There was then another interesting episode where rich nations were hoarding the PPE equipment and the masks, and there were even cases of shipments being kidnapped because we needed that equipment for us. And so what I think with vaccines, I think it's more of the same. And it is a case of we need those vaccines, but I'm going to take care of my own before I worry about anyone else. And so the fact that the rich nations not only are taking more vaccines that they need, but they know that some of those vaccines, and we're talking about millions, are going wasted because we know that they have a shelf life. But it doesn't matter because we have to look after ourselves. And, you know, we have 90% of people vaccinated, and yet now we're thinking about a third vaccination. And so we have to make sure that we have the vaccines for us and not for others. So the logic of this is the right thing to do because we're looking after our own, I find quite disturbing. And so I'm wondering whether actually there is an element of violence in what we're doing in terms of hoarding the vaccines.
And do now, you, I suppose a key question there would be whether that is conscious or unconscious, whether this right. is some kind of amour de soi, or it's a conscious effort to keep others down, to exclude others from wheresoever in the world they may be.
You're right. So you're talking about conscious and unconscious. In the literature on violence, one of the big questions is whether an act of violence is intentional or not intentional. Now, of course, that's an important question in terms of criminal law. But in fact, there is a great deal of violence that is not intentional. What makes it an act of violence is not whether it was done with deliberate aim of harming another person, but whether your actions had the foreseeable consequence of harming others. So if let's say that you and I are crossing the desert and we have one bottle of water, and I take the bottle and I drink the whole bottle. Now, I'm doing it with intention of looking after my own interests. I'm not doing it to harm you, but it's totally foreseeable that if I drink the water and you don't,
I'll die.
That you'll die. Now, you know, I could turn around and say, but I didn't mean to. That's not the, but, it, you know, from the point of view of the person who's the victim or survivor of an act of violence, the intention is actually only part of the story. Mm. You know, if I decide to drive home after drinking 10 pints, well, my intention is to get home, not to run anyone over. But I know that that's a foreseeable risk. And if I do, then that is an act of violence. And so I'm interested in violence not as just intentional, but as foreseeable. And so the question of intentionality is important. And, of course, that's a key term that comes up in the legal definition of genocide.
And so it pertains to the vaccination question, if you will, because so many countries stockpiled intentionally vaccination for their own people, but they also overstockpiled what is effectively the medical version of a fast-moving consumer good. It has an expiry date. It's not like you're stockpiling tins of beans that your people can eat until the end of time. These will expire. But they stockpile them furthermore in the context of a global conversation about how stockpiling is unfavourable.
Absolutely. And it's that international conversation that I'm not sure we're having. Or maybe people don't want to have it, or maybe people don't want to hear it if people are having that conversation. Because at the end of the day, people are just concerned about their own. Now, it's very hard to have definitive numbers on this, and depending on who you read, they'll give you slightly different numbers. But I haven't come across anyone suggesting that the low-income countries have more than 4% of the vaccines that they need. So, you know, we in Europe are looking at 90% plus, and in other parts of the world, we're looking at under 5%. Now, that's it's grotesque. And we're doing it knowing that the vaccines that we're keeping, some of them will go wasted. Mm. And somehow that's okay. And I just don't see how that's feasible in a modern world.
And I think a lot of people, a lot of countries will say there is nothing wrong with looking after ourselves or our own. We can also, at the same time, look after others. But is that attitude immoral or unethical if there's a time lag between looking after your own and looking after others? Must they be aligned in terms of, or concurrent in order to not be genocidal, if you will?
I think that's a very good question. And of course, to some extent, I'm not sure it really works anyway, because this is a pandemic. And a pandemic, it's not something that you can solve just by looking after your own. So there should have been a global perspective to the way that we deal with the pandemic. But what we had, which was totally predictable, is the rich nations looking after themselves and then perhaps looking after the others. Also, the way that we have looked after the others has been through acts of, at best, acts of generosity, of charity. And I do have a problem with that, because justice is not about charity. Justice is about procedures and institutions. And there was nothing in place to make sure that there was an equitable distribution of vaccines. It was first come, first served, and who could pay the most. So, of course, everyone wants to look after their own, but the disparity, it's just so big that it is problematic from a moral point of view, which is what I'm interested in as a moral philosopher. But also, I actually think it's short-sighted because we can't pretend that what is going on in other parts of the world is not going to affect us, because that's how a pandemic works.
Well, Vittorio Bafucci of the Department of Philosophy at University College Cork, food for thought indeed. And I'm joined on the line by Wayne Stanley. He lives here in County Kildare. He is also National Spokesperson and Head of Policy and Communications at the Simon Communities Ireland. Wayne, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara. Thanks for having me on.
We'll touch on Budget 2022 in just a moment. But first, I wanted to speak to you about comments on better coordination, better alignment, better engagement between the organisations, voluntary and statutory, working to support people in homelessness in Dublin. There's a shocking number of them. I know that there was an article in recent days that said that there were 27 such organisations, often overlapping.
Yeah, that is the case. And I think what we need to do is to take stock of where we are. I mean, the vast majority of the people who do those, go out on the street and attempt to engage with and support people who are experiencing homelessness, are doing it from the very best space. Mm. They're also maybe not aware of the statutory services that are there. So we need to find a way of coordinating, of maybe the local authorities in those areas taking a lead and bringing us all together to ensure that people have the level of training they need and they can provide the supports as they might wish to. And we can make the best use of everybody's efforts.
Because I would imagine that there is an enormous amount of effort that goes in and planning and organisation and fundraising and accruing donations in setting up an organisation, even at the very grassroots level, that will support people in homelessness or indeed in any area of life in which there may be a need to which others in the community want to respond. And arguably, instead of people setting up more organisations, their personal efforts may be better served by engaging with those that exist and already have their structures in place.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid point. I mean, obviously, the Simon Communities across Ireland were set up by volunteers, and that's a big part of who we are. And there are hundreds and thousands even of volunteers who engage with the Simon Communities every year, and we support them in the work, and they're a huge support to the work of Simon. We're always open to people who want to volunteer and play a role in helping us to end homelessness. So I think you're right. And we can build upon that support, and those people can be a part of the system that is working to end homelessness every day.
Arguably, it will be a very delicate job of work were, for example, the charities regulator to say, OK, but there are too many, not that I understand that it's not within their gift, but were an organisation of a similar bent to say, look, we need to amalgamate here. There are too many people doing the same thing and it would be better served if you all came together or branched off into smaller groups, because an awful lot of people, particularly in those grassroots organisations, Wayne, are deeply committed to their project and to hear, and understandably so, and to hear perhaps that in some way they're superfluous, even though they aren't, would be deeply disturbing to them.
Yeah, I think everyone can understand that. People of goodwill go out and do get invested on the relationships that they build and the services that they're providing. I think that's why there's a need for the coordination part of it, because I think when people understand the systems that are there and can see how they can do more good, they will respond positively. I mean, the fact that people are acting in goodwill, I believe, is the vast majority of the driver of the proliferation of these services. I think a lot of people don't understand or aren't aware of the supports that are there for people, and they think that homelessness, particularly for those who are sleeping rough, that the services that are there are, you know, think that we're in a situation that maybe we were many, many years ago, whereas we're not. They're often already been engaged with by services, and we're working with them to build confidence and even put them directly into a home in the case of those who maybe have been rough sleeping for a long time. So that level of engagement requires trained, delicate work. And if people don't know that that's happening, they're going to try and engage people in ways that perhaps may be less helpful than they imagine it to be. So what we need to do is go forward. We need to explain to people what's happening. We need them to engage with their local authorities. And to be sure that, you know, if we were doing anything else, we would always want to be sure that we were adding to the benefit of everybody. And I think because there's an immediate thing around providing a food or a sleeping bag, you know, the assumption is built into that it's absolutely the right thing to do. It certainly comes from the right humanitarian place, but sometimes it's about engaging people into the right services.
Then in terms of the budget today, homelessness absolutely contributed to by housing crisis, by rising cost of rent, etc. We've seen of late worrying increase in the number of families with children who are homeless. And then we see budget 2022. I know Rory Hearn from Maynooth University is saying investor funds will continue to laugh into their martinis at the expense of generation rent. This budget fails to freeze rents or cap new rents, continues investor fund tax breaks, no vacant homes tax, no immediate major state build of affordable housing. That's just his take. Would that align with what you have been able to discern thus far?
Well, obviously, we're just getting into the detail of it, but the initial, I suppose, the initial positives are the government commitment to housing for all and the targets within that. The concerns, immediate concerns we see is the housing assistance payment is continuing to expand at its current rates. And we know and we see at our front line that people are having to top up and aren't able to afford to meet the cost of their rent and are getting into arrears, which is going to see an increase in homelessness. So what I think what we're seeing here is the HAP system continuing to expand without a necessary provision being put in to increase the rates to ensure that it keeps people in the home that they need. I think more broadly, we are seeing what we're looking to see as well, which we don't have the detail on yet, is what's going to be done around prevention and keeping people in their home. As you know, over the COVID period, we did see a fall in the number of people in homelessness, and that was directly because the COVID restrictions and the moratorium on evictions put a barrier there to people entering into homelessness. What we now need to do is build up the supports to ensure that we're able to prevent people coming into homelessness. It's not clear to me where the budget for that will be yet, but that is something we're going to be talking to the department out as we look at where the 194 million that they're putting into homeless services, where that's going to be spent.
Wayne Stanley, Kildare resident and indeed national spokesperson and head of policy at communications at the Simon Communities of Ireland. Thank you indeed for joining us.